From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So today, most of your Thanksgiving meal will be about sustenance, the turkey, the potatoes. But the pumpkin pie, that is something else. The food historian Michael Crondall says dessert is a cultural phenomenon. It's not about what we need, but what we desire. And the fact that dessert, from the biological standpoint, is unnecessary or frivolous is what interests him. Crondall has written a book about the history of dessert, an exploration of the way sweet things have been used by different cultures in different times. And today in the program, he'll join us to talk about it. Dessert, he says, fulfills the sort of needs that make our species unique. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Just wait. Today, after the turkey and the piles of starch, you're going to hanker for something sweet. It's the American way, this hankering. Well, it's not just American. Throughout our history, in fact, humans have had a sweet tooth. And there's something biological to all of this, but that's not the part that interests the food historian Michael Crondall. The thing that makes dessert interesting to Crondall is that it's less about human need as human desire. So while stuffing and potatoes are about sustenance, pumpkin pie is about pleasure. In his book about the history of dessert, Crondall says, when you talk about sweets, you step away from analyzing basic human needs to a conversation about culture. And dessert, he says, is a purely cultural phenomenon. Michael Crondall's previous books include two cookbooks and The Taste of Conquest, The Rise and Fall of the Three Great Cities of Spice. He's joining us today from a studio in New York City. And Michael Crondall, welcome. Thank you very much for being with
us. Thank you so much.
Well, you begin the book. I wanted to start, as you do, with this epiphany that you write about. You and I assume it's your wife traveled to Belgium. Is that right?
Well, she wasn't my wife at the time, but she is now.
You got it. Okay. And so you had sort of talked amongst each other about this trek there as this kind of research expedition. But you have this epiphany that you write about that's an important part of the book. Talk about it, if you would.
Well, here we were in Belgium, and if you've ever been to Belgium, you've probably noticed that the weather is, conducive to a couple of things. Being outside is not one of them, though. Belgium also happens to have this amazing selection of chocolate. We all know Belgian chocolate, right? So we would spend sort of the days wandering around looking for chocolate shops. And when we got tired of that, well, we would go to the pastry shops. And eventually we were in, I'm trying to figure out the town we were in. I think it was near Bruges. And we'd sort of bicycled out into the fog. The other thing Belgians do all the time is they bicycle. So we'd bicycled along these canals into the fog and arrived at this little village hamlet, which had a church and a pastry shop, and that was about it. Mm. And so we go into the pastry shop, and we're sitting there, and it's just us. It's a weekday afternoon. It's drizzly outside. And these two ladies come in. They sit there, and they talk. And, you know, I'm kind of spying to see what they're going to have for dessert because they had a really remarkable collection for a place in the middle of what seemed like nowhere.
Yeah.
And so they sit down and they're talking. And eventually the waitress brings off over these desserts. And you'd think, you know, they're kind of stylish ladies. They'd be delicate little things. But no. These are enormous plates with at least three slices of dessert on them. And the women kind of look at them, the desserts, that is. Mm. They look at each other, and the conversation just stops. And they very, very systematically, yet elegantly, go through every single crumb on those plates. And I mean, these women were in no way overweight.
Yeah.
And there was this sort of level of concentration and this level of almost like aesthetic rapture, if I may use that term, that had nothing to do with all those kind of basic human needs that you mentioned earlier. It had nothing to do with, you know, these women were not eating this because they read some diet book that they should, or that they necessarily even ate it because their bodies needed it. But their bodies desired it in a way that, I don't know, the way we desire aesthetic experiences. And after they'd finished eating everything, and I was just amazed, the conversation picked up again, and it's as if they'd gone to a musical performance or something, and they were now going to converse about what it is that they saw or heard. But in this case, they were going to converse about, you know, the consistency of the cream and the crispness of the crust and all this sort of stuff. So, yeah, it was this sort of epiphany that pleasure was something that was essential, that was just sort of... It wasn't something that, you know, in our culture, I think we think that work is essential and pleasure is something that you kind of do on the side and we're a little bit embarrassed about it. But in other cultures, that's not necessarily the case. There, you work to live. You don't live to work.
Mm. It seems like that is a theme just underneath everything in the book in some ways. I have to say that, you know, this question that you ask, you know, is a life of self-denial, is it really worth living? This idea of pleasure seems to really intrigue you.
And maybe it's an issue of envy, because I think I come from that background where, you know, you're supposed to be working all the time and that pleasure is somehow looked down upon and pleasure is something that is slightly, maybe not slightly sinful, maybe quite sinful. There's been recently this tremendous kind of demonization of sugar, which I find fascinating because, of course, you know, true enough, Americans eat way too much sweetener, whether it's sugar or corn syrup. And I'm not going to argue with that, but the amount of pleasure that most Americans get from that sugar is downing a 20-ounce or more bottle of some sort of a soda. That's not what I'm talking about. Yeah. I'm talking about this idea that I think in our culture, foods that are purely there to give us pleasure are somehow, well, we're going to be damned if we eat them. You know, we're going to be sent straight to hell for eating just maybe a little bit too much of that ice cream.
So at what point did you figure, now you're a food historian, so I guess in some ways some of the subject makes, you know, makes practical sense. But at what point did you figure you wanted to write a book like this, that focused on the idea not just of, you know, a really pragmatic kind of history, though in some ways the book is that, but kind of a history of these pleasures?
Well, I think it comes out of this, how do I just say this in a succinct way? I think it comes out of the fact that as human beings, you know, it's the old story, we don't live by bread alone. So when I was looking more and more into the idea of dessert, I was discovering that each culture really has this almost, well, cultural approach and in some cases even religious approach. I think where it really took off was when I went to India. I had wanted to go back to India. I had done some work in India for the Spice book, and I'd wanted to go back to India. And I really didn't know very much about Indian desserts. And then gradually I did more and more work on it. And I realized that in India, desserts are completely tied up with religion.
Yeah.
So that the very first desserts that Indians came up with were really offerings to the gods. And then I sort of started digging some more into this. And then the ancient Babylonians, you know, their first sweetmeats, their first desserts were these kind of fruitcakes developed as offerings in temples. And then I was looking into the history of donuts. And, you know, we think donuts, we think Dunkin' Donuts, we think Homer Simpson.
Right.
But when you start kind of poking around, you realize that donuts were very traditional for the period before Lent. They were traditional for, you know, carnival. Why? Because for carnival, after carnival, for Lent, you had to use up all the fat so that you would make all these donuts just before, as this kind of orgy of fat eating, before you had to abstain for the 30 days and 30 nights. So this association with religion made me realize, okay, well, this isn't just, you know, I'm not just totally making this up. Cultures have this very powerful relationship with sweetness that has to do with physiology, but it has a lot to do with things like religion, like culture, like ostentation, like conspicuous consumption, you know, all these other things that are more like jewelry, or they're more like fashion. Yeah. They're less like food in some ways.
Well, I guess the sort of practical part in some ways is that it was seen as special or rare. But that's not the part that interests you as much as the pleasure part. That's why they're connected with life's passages, as you put it in the book, is because it's about the pleasure part, the desire part that really, really seems to get to you.
I think on some level it does, yeah. And I do think that this is some sort of a psychological problem that I have.
Well, let's define our terms, because we're not talking about candy. I mean, your focus is on dessert, that course usually served, at least these days, at the end of a meal.
You know, that was tough, actually, figuring out what was dessert and what was candy.
Yeah, I was going to say, how did you sort of figure all of that out? Because you do refer to some candies in some ways.
Because I just couldn't avoid it. Yeah. But it was really hard to figure out, you know, what's a Snickers bar? A Snickers bar is candy, right?
Yeah.
What's a brownie?
Dessert. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And the line between – and then, you know, what is fudge? Fudge is candy. And the line between candy – in the case of fudge, the difference between a really, really fudgy brownie and a piece of fudge isn't that big.
Yeah.
So somewhere you had to I just had to make a decision. Okay, this is candy, this is not. The other decision I had to make was, is this really fit into what we think of dessert? So that it can't just be sweet. We eat pancakes for breakfast. They're not dessert. Nobody in America thinks of them as dessert. But you go to France and crepes are certainly dessert. You know, yeah. You fill them with Nutella, you fold them over, you eat them in the streets in Paris. That is clearly not considered breakfast. I was recently doing some research into donuts. I have a bit of a donut fixation. And, you know, donuts, breakfast, coffee, donuts.
Yeah. Yeah.
But donuts are dessert, right? They're not breakfast. Or are they?
I don't know. I mean, it seems like that this idea of dessert that, you know, that is something that you eat at the end of the meal. You talk about the fact that that's a pretty recent idea, but sweet things, I guess this hankering for sweet things, that's always been a part of human civilization, do you figure?
Well, I think it's part of being a human being. Yeah. I think that, you know, we as higher primates evolved to like sweet, dislike bitter, salty, we're kind of on the fence about, and sour we tend to dislike. You give an infant sugar and they will eat it. You give them anything in the least bit bitter or sour and they will spit it out. And in some cultures they go so far, for example in the Middle East, before a child will actually breastfeed, they will give them a little bit of sweetness, usually in the form of dates or honey. So their very, very first taste of life is sweet. And of course that's symbolic, right? You want the child to have a sweet life. And all of these words we have, sweetheart, sweetie, nobody has, you know, or on the other hand, sourpuss.
Yeah.
So sweetness is just, it's inborn. The desire for sweetness is inborn. But infants don't come up with soccer torts and, you know, gâteaux.
Right. You know, the other thing that I find interesting about the book is that and we'll come to this as we go, but dessert seems for a good part of history anyway has been about fashion and about trends. And innovation seems like an important part of the story of dessert.
Well, that's why I initially or a little while ago mentioned that it was in some ways a little bit like clothing or fashion.
Yeah.
Now, dessert until, about 150 years ago was a luxury because sugar was just so darn expensive. So it was a luxury reserved for the upper classes. And the upper classes used dessert kind of in the same way that they would use, you know, a new outfit as a way to show off. And very often this was a field that was dominated by women who would invite other women over. And of course they had to, you know, keep up with the Joneses. They had to make sure that it was the latest and the greatest. And that there was this kind of supply and demand situation where pastry cooks, even more than regular cooks, really had to come up with something new, something new, something new to distinguish themselves from the competition.
I wanted to ask you about the rules, because a lot of this conversation is about rules. How many social rules we have for dessert? They're all over the place.
They are. To go back to my wife, she absolutely forbids our daughter to have anything that she thinks of as dessert before noon. And I'm fascinated by this because when I grew up, we would eat meals. I grew up in what is now the Czech Republic, and we would make whole meals, kind of supper, out of sweet things we would have. My grandmother would sort of pull down this big pan, this big metal pan, and would essentially make these yeast-leavened pancakes, which we would then sit down to eat at 8 o'clock, 7 o'clock at night, with usually homemade prune butter or apple butter. And this was dinner. And to an American, that would be kind of breakfast. So that the rules are very, very kind of, they change depending on the culture a great deal. And when it comes to having that dessert at the end of the meal, well, some cultures do that and some cultures don't. And it right. completely seems arbitrary.
When did the idea of, well, the whole book is about how we sort of got there. But as I said before, it's a pretty recent idea that, okay, you're finished with this course and then this course and then this course, which seems to have come from the Turks in some ways. You know, that kind of ordering of meal, which was really sure. fascinating, I have to say. Then we, and then at the end, now we need something sweet.
Well, if you look at the, you know, the history of dessert, which is probably as old as civilization, so, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 years, give or take 1,000, certainly this idea of serving a distinct sweet course only at the end of the meal probably only goes back about 150, 200 years.
Yeah.
And it goes back to the French, yeah. you know, the ones who invented so many things that we think of as fine dining. And there was a point at which the French would eat basically buffet style. They would have these two, maybe three big courses of food. They would arrive all on the table at once, and there'd be your creme brulee next to your pigeon pie, next to your, you know, roast pheasant. And you would kind of eat what you wanted, sort of like our Thanksgiving, if you want to compare it to that. And then eventually, sort of in the early 19th century, the French started to eat in distinct individual courses. And this may have something to do with restaurants, because it was impractical to serve big buffet-style meals in restaurants.
Yeah.
And so people would begin to have this one course after another, after another, after another. And whereas before that, there'd be a savory course mixed with a few sweet things and another savory course mixed with a very few sweet things and then a mostly sweet course mixed with a few savory things. Eventually, the rule became savory, 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 sweet, sweet. And that's where we are kind of now. And yeah, it's very much of a French invention that probably happened, you know, as Napoleon was retiring to Elba.
Michael Crandall is with us. He's a food historian. He's the author of the book Sweet Invention, A History of Dessert. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, as you all prepare for that last part of the Thanksgiving meal, the sweet part, we're offering a little context for it all. The food historian Michael Crandall is our guest today to talk about the history of dessert. There may be something evolutionary in our desire for a sweet taste, but the thing that makes dessert so interesting to Crandall is that it's less about human need as human desire. His book is called Sweet Invention, A History of Dessert. So Michael Crandall, let's go back to India. I mean, you write about, you talk about in the book how you have to be just, it isn't all-encompassing, more about breadth than depth, you say, and you focused on desserts that you sort of see as culturally significant, and you focus on these different countries, and you start with India because, I guess because you say they have this kind of national obsession over dessert.
They have a national obsession. It is intricately tied to their religion. If you look at stories of the gods, so you have, you know, Krishna, who I think we're all vaguely familiar with, was one of the incarnations of sort of one of the most important gods. And there's all these stories about Krishna stealing butter and stealing milk. And then there's stories of the elephant god kind of giving him little treats and little sweets to eat. There's other stories about the elephant god where the elephant god is sort of stumbling through through the woods, having eaten way, way, way too much of his favorite dessert, which is something called a modaka, which is a kind of a rice dumpling stuffed full of sugar and coconut. And so he's sort of wandering along, and he's totally stuffed, and he can barely stand it anymore, and he stumbles, falls down, his stomach bursts open, and the moon is looking down at him and starts laughing uproariously. And the elephant god gets very, very angry and looks up and says, "You are never going to shine on this earth ever again." And the moon is, you know, banished. And of course, all the other gods are upset and they say, "Please, please, 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 would you, you know, get the moon to come back?" And so he relents. And ever since then, though, the moon is cursed with waxing and waning. So at the very center of this is the idea of overeating dessert and how that somehow, next thing you know, you're talking about the moon. So it is very, very central to the culture. You know, they have the equivalent of something called Brother's Day in India, which is sort of like our Valentine's Day, except that instead of men giving sweets to women, women give sweets to men. And specifically, it's supposed to be sisters to brothers, but these days it's, you know, pretty well any woman to any man, you know, in an office situation, for example. And that comes in the middle of these two other holidays, basically completely devoted to sweets. There's Diwali on the one side, where it's, again, like our Christmas, where but people give gifts of dessert. And then there's, you know, other holidays on the other side where the same thing happens. So there is, and I think we don't understand it here because most of the Indian desserts that we find here either are not very good quality or most Indian restaurants don't even offer them. So there is this almost ignorance. The other thing about India, of course, is that they started refining sugar first. They were the first ones to do it. So they've had a much longer time to figure it out.
Well, you'd write about how when you walk into one of these Indian sweet shops, you say it's a bit like a bird watcher in the Amazon. I mean, there are all these colors and all these shapes, and it's really hard to make sense of it all.
Well, it is a little bit like walking into, you know, imagine that you're a space alien and then you walk into Dunkin' Donuts and you see all these things on the wall and you think, wow, what variety they have in this, you know, place. And you realize that it's all basically the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, one has a slightly different glaze on it, one is filled, but they're fundamentally all kind of the same thing. It's a little bit like a lot of Indian sweet shops. You walk into it and you think, wow, what magnificent variety. And then you start poking into it a little bit and you realize, okay, those 18 over there are made with this way and are just colored different ways and shaped different ways. Those 18 are made this way. So once you've kind of figured out a kind of, you know, a system for this, you realize that it's not actually that difficult.
You point out that sugar, you know, of course, it isn't the only sweetener that we have. It was but you say sugar is special. I mean, you focus on sugar in particular. Talk about that, if you would. Why you – and particularly
sugar
in India.
Sugar is special in both a good way, I think, and a bad way. In a good way, sugar is special from a purely kind of a craft standpoint. You can do all sorts of things with sugar that you can't do with honey, that you can't do with maple syrup, that you can't do with even cornstarch corn syrup. So you can, for example, turn it into caramel, which becomes crisp and crunchy. You can beat it into certain cakes, which gives the moistness. You can make it sort of half cook it so that it's chewy like a candy. You can make it into a syrup so that it absorbs into other things. So you can do all these things with sugar that you can't do quite as well with the other sweeteners. Of course, the other way that sugar is unique, and this is the, you know, the dark side of the story, which you can't avoid when you talk about dessert, is that sugar became the motivator of the slave trade. The reason that, you know, that horrible transmigration that happened was because of the sugar plantations in the Caribbean, because Europeans wanted more sweet stuff.
Do we know, you talk about that it's not entirely clear where sugar cane comes from when they first started. I mean, you talk about when we first started cultivating, I guess, and when the first sugar plantations and stuff like that. But do we know much about the origin of people saying, "Hey, this is sweet. Let's crush it and boil it and all of those things.
Well, I'm no expert in this, so I can only tell you what I've read. Yeah. And there seems to be a mostly accepted theory that sugar seems to have been endemic to both Papua New Guinea, so somewhere in Southeast Asia, and also to India. There were certain different varieties. And that eventually the ones from Papua New Guinea managed to get to India, and there they figured out, oh, if we boil this stuff down, it crystallizes. However, I think the idea of, you know, just picking this sweet cane and just chewing at it probably goes back, well, to Stone Age prehistory.
You write about India, of course, and you sort of take us through these three particular eras of India. Of course, at some point, you have to start talking about the Middle East when you're talking about the history of dessert. The Middle East seems like kind of, I don't know, the basis for it in many ways.
Well, if you look about, you know, it's the reason it's called the Middle East, it's in the middle. It's where the agricultural revolution started. It's presumably where the very, very first desserts were made, probably with honey and dried fruits rather than with sugar. But so it is where everything sort of begins. It's the place where the three great, you know, Judeo-Christian Muslim religions came from. Yeah. So it is critical. And in some ways, it is also the birthplace of so many different kinds of desserts. Persia, oddly enough, maybe not oddly enough, but Persia, because it was such a crossroad, seems to be where everything kind of comes through. It comes through on the way from India to the Middle East, from the Middle East to India, from Central Asia and China. So it becomes a sort of meeting ground for all these ideas of sweetness. Mm.
You write about one of the oldest cake recipes in the world, a fragment, really, that dates back to 1,400 years before the Common Era, kind of an enriched cake. I guess it's not. Would you be able to reproduce it? Was it a recipe?
You couldn't. You couldn't. There are no quantities. But it's essentially a fruit cake. Huh. I mean, if you look at today's recipes for fruit cakes, now that Christmas is coming up, that fruit cake, I keep thinking, well, is it that original fruit cake that is still being passed around? But it's dried fruit,
yeah,
held together with flour, you know, no brandy on it, but it's fruitcake, recognizably so.
Do you think that, today everything is made, and it's so refined. I mean, the flours are refined, the sugars are refined. If we would have tasted one of these ancient cakes or ancient desserts or ancient sweets, would it seem foreign? Would it seem familiar? I mean, do you have any sense of that?
Well, the ones that we're talking about that are, you know, 3,000+ years old, I honestly don't. Mm-hmm. Because we don't really know what exactly the ingredients in it were. And, for example, one of the very, very early recipes seems to be calling for all these sweet ingredients and then also garlic. So that's completely incongruous to us. We don't understand how that could be. If there's one flavor that doesn't seem to go with sweet, it is garlicky. But the later desserts, by the time you get down to the Middle Ages, the recipes are pretty accurate and are pretty reproducible. So yes, there I think we could say, I know exactly what this tasted like, and it doesn't taste so different from what you might find in a Middle Eastern bakery.
You talk about how the Arabs had the idea of packing damp raw sugar into these big, I'm trying to imagine them actually, these big earthenware cones, I think is how you describe it. And they, mm-hmm, they have a little hole in the bottom. And this was the technique that, I guess, hundreds of years we used this technique.
Sure. I mean, it starts, around 1,000 AD, and then really, they didn't come up with a different way of refining until more or less the 18th century. So what you would do is you would, just to give a little bit of background, when you are growing sugar, you grow the sugar cane, and then you squeeze out the juice.
Yeah.
And there's different ways of doing this. And then you boil down the juice. And what you're left with is this sort of really, really brown sugar with this molasses in it. And then if you pack that really, really brown sugar into a cone in this case, and allow it to drip down through, you'll get this beautiful actually sort of range from very, very dark brown at the very tip to almost pure white at the base. And the stuff at the base used to be much more expensive, the white stuff, yeah, than the dark brown stuff.
Talk about, I wanted to get to some particular desserts as we go to. Baklava is interesting because so many different countries claim baklava.
Well, what I find interesting about certain foods, and baklava may be the best example of all of them, is that you can almost trace the outlines of an ancient empire by just seeing where baklava was eaten, much more so than with language. Language, you would think, would leave its residues, but not as much as food does. So that if you go to all the places that baklava is now claimed as the local dessert, the main local dessert, you'll find the outlines of the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish Empire, in Syria, in Southeast Europe, in Greece, of course. And there, of course, is this big fight, as there always seems to be, between the Greeks and the Turks. Who invented baklava?
Right.
And I'm not going to get into that fight. But suffice it to say that where the Ottomans once ruled is where you find baklava today. So the empire may be 100 years gone, but its effects on especially one particular food are certainly still there.
Here's an email from Cody, who writes from Salt Lake City. Why, he writes, why birthday and wedding cake rather than a birthday torte or a wedding pie? I mean, maybe you could talk about how we end up with cakes, because it is a part of the book. The wedding cake, for example, the Renaissance pastry chefs and sculptors who created these things. How did we end up with a birthday or the wedding cake?
Well, there's slightly different issues. I think when it comes to any life passage, there have always been sweets associated with
sure.
it. Whether it's birth, whether it's, you know, the Day of the Dead when you have sugar skulls, whether it's certain feast days for various saints. And so you would want to have something fancy and special for those days. Those fancy and special things, though, varied depending on the culture. For example, in France, they don't have a wedding cake. What they do is they have a pile of cream puffs.
Yeah.
And this is what they serve at a wedding. It's magnificent, it's large, it's fancy, but it looks nothing like what we would call a wedding cake. This idea of the wedding cake seems to come from the British. And there was some sort of a fancy cake that was served well back into probably the 18th century. And in the United States as well, you would have these giant cakes that would be baked for special occasions like elections. You would have election cakes.
Yeah.
And, you know, the recipes say take 60 pounds of flour, 30 pounds of sugar, 150 eggs and mix it up and bake it, type of thing. In Britain, there was this funny kind of combination of French technique because the British aristocracy was hiring French chefs.
Yeah.
And this tradition of having a wedding cake. And so whereas in France, they would have these magnificent sort of centerpieces made out of pastry and, you know, little cream puffs and little cookies, and these things would be built into these magnificent architectural kind of structures. The English sort of picked this idea up but started using it for the imperial or the royal weddings. And so particularly Queen Victoria's daughters would have these three-story, four-story you know, architectural creations.
Yeah.
And increasingly, the Victorians thought, okay, well, they should be white because white is virginal, and these cakes were often called bride's cakes. And eventually, this idea of these bride's cakes, these pure white cakes, was picked up in the United States because particularly the British royalty, when they got married, well, the idea of them getting a lot of publicity from the American press is nothing new. So the American press just ate this up, and there were pictures of this wedding cake. And basically, if you wanted to have a wedding like a princess in America, you wanted to have one of these cakes of a real princess in Britain. And so this idea of this multi-story white thing took off. And then it's been picked up elsewhere around the world. So originally, wedding cakes were really an English and an American invention. And now if you want to have a wedding in, I don't know, you know, Vienna, you will order a multi-story wedding cake. which isn't a Viennese thing at all.
Mm. What do you make of all of these this is not exactly featured in your book, but I'm so interested in these cable programs that are focused on these novelty cakes, which seem to kind of amount to fondant for the most part. But I mean, what do you make of that, where that fits? Does that sort of fit in the tradition of the way Americans, the American spin on cake, I guess?
I think there's two things going on there. I think that there is this very, very long tradition of, because sugar is this kind of fancy, frilly, and also very workable substance. Yeah. You know, you can't forget the fact that we go back to, you can make fondant out of sugar, you can't make fondant out of maple syrup.
Yeah.
So that it is workable and it is usable. So that's one thing. So there's a long tradition of this, goes to, you know, Carême and even back to the Renaissance and maybe even back to ancient or medieval Cairo. So I think there's a long tradition for this, and people like doing it because they get to show off. But I think there's a separate idea, which is that sugar work has always been very much about visuals. You know, the cakes, the wedding cakes, the birthday cakes, they're all about prettiness. And when you look at television, television is all about visuals. You don't care what the cake tastes like on television.
Yeah.
The only thing that's really important is what it looks like. And the crazier and the wackier it turns into, like the great world of wrestling. The crazier the outfits of the wrestlers, the crazier the cake, the more of an audience it gets. So it becomes about this kind of sensational visual representation of something. Any of those chef competitions. It's about the story, because nobody in the audience really gets to taste the stuff.
It seems like when you're talking about, because you write about the difference between, for example, the kind of the American sensibility and kind of the European sensibility when it's in terms of the way it's reflected in desserts. And you talk about these two particular trends. The most notable dessert craze, you talk about the macaron. That's a European sort of trend, I guess. Although, of course, you can get them here, of course. But then the American sort of trend is the cupcake. And they both reflect a kind of difference in culture. I mean, work through that with us, if you would, because you write about that in the book.
Well, I think when it comes to cupcakes and macaron, they're both a lovely example of both very much kind of ingrained cultural ideas, but at the same time, they're completely a phenomenon of globalization.
Yeah.
So that these days you go to Vienna or you go to Singapore and there are these cupcakes on offer. You go to New York or you go to Singapore and you have the macaron on order, on offer. So that they're both everywhere. They're both ubiquitous. But they're both in some ways have this kind of different symbolism. The cupcake. A cupcake is this thing that you pick up by hand, and it's something that's associated with childhood. It's what you got when you had your birthday parties.
Yeah, yeah.
It's what you brought to school during, you know, the bake sale. Basically, anybody can make a cupcake, and in fact, most people make their cupcakes out of mixes, right? They get a cake mix, they cook it in the cupcake pan. The people who are too lazy to make it from a mix go to crumbs, and they get a slightly fancier version of it, but the texture still comes from this kind of Duncan Hines kind of texture. So to me, they're yet another symbol, yet another representation of how Americans love to hold on to their childhoods. Mm. You know, look at the average American man in his 40s. He's dressed, on the weekend at any rate, he's dressed in jeans, he's got a baseball cap on, he's got a t-shirt on that says something on it, and he's got sneakers on, right? I mean, he's got the uniform of Little League. And the cupcake is sort of the equivalent of that. It's this childhood treat. It's comforting. It's simple. You kind of get a little bit messy eating it. Now, of course, it's international like everything else is these days. When it comes to the macaron, it's almost the opposite. It is this tiny, little, exquisite thing that basically is really, really hard to make unless you've had years of experience. They're a major pain to make. It tends to come in all of these kind of wacky flavors. So lychee and, you know, green tea and rose and whatever. So to eat it is, if you are in New York or Singapore, it's kind of like you're showing that you're sophisticated, right? I mean, you know a little bit about the world. You're eating this fancy French thing. It's not messy. You can eat it in one or two bites. Mm. Yet both things are very informal. So they are very 21st century in that way. Both things are international, globalized, so they are very much that way as well. And, you know, if somebody makes a durian, which is kind of the stinky fruit cupcake in Singapore, the people in Paris will know about it 5 minutes later.
Michael Crandall is with us, food historian, author of the book Sweet Inventions, A History of Dessert. We need to take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the food historian Michael Crandall. We're talking about his book, Sweet Invention, A History of Dessert. Michael Crandall, talk about pie, if you would. That was referred to in a question or two we've been getting via email. And I'm wondering, you write about the Middle Ages, kind of the golden age of pie, maybe not the pie that we necessarily think of, but talk about the history of pie.
Well, I think pie is the perfect thing to talk about this week, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, in the Middle Ages in Europe, a lot of people didn't have ovens. And if they needed to bake something, they would stick it in some sort of a pastry shell and they would take it over to the baker and the baker would stick it in the oven, bake it, and they would bring it home. And what that something was, well, it could be meat, it could be fruit, it could be a mixture of not so much vegetables, but usually it was meat or fruit. And then they would go home and eat it. And depending on the kind of pie, and that was called pie.
Yeah.
And depending on the kind of pie it was, sometimes the shell would be thick and inedible. And it would just be a container made with the cheapest possible flour imaginable. Or sometimes it was relatively delicate with butter or possibly lard or suet in it so that you could actually eat the outside of it. In fact, remember the old a story about Marie Antoinette, how Marie Antoinette, the peasants were starving, and she walks out on the balcony and yells to the peasants, "Well, let them eat cake."
Yeah.
She didn't say it, but be that as it may,
right.
There was an earlier French princess who in fact said, "Well, the peasants are starving, well, let them eat the crust on the pies." Of course, I think she was implying that that crust wasn't so good in those days. But the idea of pies goes back the Middle Ages all over Europe, really, very popular. And it sort of lost its popularity in most of the rest of Europe, but kept its popularity in Britain. So if you look at apple pie, for example, we have recipes that go back, the 1300s, 1400s.
Wow.
So apple pie is maybe as, as American as apple pie, but it well predates the discovery of America by the Europeans.
Well, you also mentioned that the casings for some pies were baked blind, as you call it.
Right. Well, in many cases, and here's a recommendation if you're making your pumpkin pie, it's best to bake your pie casing blind, that is, with nothing in it, and then later on cook the custard in it. Now, in America and in Britain, a pumpkin pie wasn't called a pumpkin pie 150, 200 years ago. It was called a pumpkin custard because there were custards that were baked in a pie shell, but those were called custards. If it was an apple pie, that would be called a pie, or in Britain, a tart. And eventually this idea comes along that in America, anything baked in a crust turns into a pie.
It's interesting that this baking the casings blind. I mean, the 4-and-20 blackbirds nursery rhyme. You make a reference to that. They used to put all kinds of things in these pies.
Well, in the Middle Ages and just a little bit in the Renaissance as well, you would have these crazy banquets where they would create all sorts of kind of containers that would resemble castles, that would resemble towers, that would resemble all sorts of things. And there would be just these pastry outsides that would be baked in that shape. And they would put things in them, like the 420 blackbirds, like a whole live pig. And then they would knock a hole or open the door of this pastry tower, and the pig would start running around in the banquet hall. So the spectacle of it was very, very important. But, you know, that disappeared by the time of the late Renaissance, and then we got to more boring things.
Right. Well, of course, a good part of the book is about America. And it's interesting you say, because, of course, our dessert tastes have been influenced by so many different kinds of cultures. But there is that thing that's interesting. Part of the story of America and dessert, it seems, is the industrialization of the country's food supply, which you write about. And this important distinction between manufactured and homemade. For Americans, this idea of being homemade is a big deal. And that seems like a distinctly an American notion, I suppose.
Well, in the book, I talk about America being kind of have this split personality, yeah. Which is, you know, some American pies are about mom and some American pies are about factories.
Yeah.
And then there are some American desserts which kind of have, you know, bridged the gap. And there's a long-standing association in the United States that mothers, specifically mothers, would be kind of baking in the kitchen. They'd be baking bread. They'd be making these wholesome desserts. And that somehow they would transmit moral virtue to the entire family by baking. More baking than cooking, incidentally.
Yeah.
And, you know, this doesn't exist in Europe. Cake is something that aristocrats ate, so you go to the pastry shop and you buy it. I mean, imagine going to Paris and seeing a big sign in the window that says, homemade dessert. You don't want homemade dessert, sort of patisserie. You want, you know, fancy desserts made by somebody who's a professional. Yet here you go to any American-style bakery, it says homemade, or there's this implication of homemade, even though there's a full-time professional working in the background. It's as if mom were still back there. One of the interesting stories about the invention of cake mix was that cake mix came along fairly early in the 1920s or so. You know, cake mix is really just baking powder, flour, sugar, and a few other ingredients mixed up, and you add water to it, and you can make a cake. But it just wasn't popular.
Yeah.
And they couldn't figure out why. And then the company, and I can't recall now whether it was Duncan Hines that was the first one or the second one, maybe it was General Mills that was the first one, hired some psychologist and why is this stuff not selling? And they kind of did their interviews, they did their market research, and they discovered that women didn't like to make their the cakes from the cake mix because it didn't feel like they were making them from scratch, that they weren't homemade. And so the psychologist suggested, well, why don't you omit one ingredient? And so they went back to the test kitchen and they recreated the recipe without the egg in it. And so now women, in order to make their Duncan Hines, would whip it up, add the water, but they would also add an egg. And somehow adding an egg turns it into
legit.
Homemade.
Yeah, right.
And the thing was that it was okay. And you actually look at surveys from the 1950s, and it was considered okay to make cakes from a cake mix in a way that it just wasn't considered okay to go to a pastry shop, because when it was homemade, it was wholesome.
Yeah,
it was mom. Whereas when you went to the pastry shop, well, God only knows what went into it then, as if we knew what goes into it when it comes from a mix, right?
You write about the future of dessert, which, again, goes back to that idea we were talking earlier about innovation. And you say most of the innovation in most of the future in dessert you see coming from restaurants.
Well, I think what happened in the United States was that innovation was taken over by industry at a certain point, and it was either women working for large corporations or cookbook authors somehow connected to large corporations, and they created very innovative things. You know, those Jell-O desserts of the 30s and the 50s. Very innovative. But now it seems like everybody's looking to professionals for innovation. And whereas retail pastry shops, at least in the United States, don't tend to be too innovative, in the restaurants they are. And part of this has to do with things that you mentioned, which was, you know, media exposure. Mm. Whoever knew who the pastry chef was in a restaurant 20 years ago? Nobody. But now you go to a restaurant and, you know, it says Jacques Torres at the bottom of that menu. And you know that the pastry chef is probably the second best paid person in the kitchen right now. Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you this finally, about less than a minute left. You say that by studying dessert, maybe we can learn a little bit more about what makes us, you know, what makes humans human. What did all of this teach you about humans, I think, ultimately, if you came to any sort of particular idea about that?
I think that we spend too much time worrying and not enough time experiencing. I think that's ultimately what it was. That pleasure really does matter, and that we will be more complete human beings if we can enjoy it without qualification.
Michael Crandall, his book is called Sweet Invention, A History of Dessert. He joined us from New York City. Michael, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you so much.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.